Production.
This meeting is now being recorded.
I can make a request that folks on the phone mute except when they have a question. Happy to entertain questions as we go along, and hopefully I've allowed enough time for discussion at the end of the webinar today. The topic, Rosh Measurement of Medical Rehabilitation, emerged from several conversations that Chris Pretz and I had over the last many months as we were using the Rosh model to analyze model systems data. And I was answering a number of questions for Chris, and we came to realize that there might be a larger audience that would appreciate an introduction to rating scale analysis or Rosh measurement. So here we are today. There are, if my screen will advance, there we go, a couple objectives. First, provide an introduction to contemporary measurement approaches that are applicable to medical rehabilitation. Describe rating scale, also known as Rosh analysis, and illustrate applications of rating scale analysis in areas relevant to medical rehabilitation. Some of the questions that people ask demonstrate the limitations of what's called classical test theory are problematic in medical rehabilitation. The FIM is certainly a familiar instrument to most of us, and some of the questions I've heard over the years are of this kind of, does a total FIM score of 70 obtained from two different patients, perhaps someone with a spinal injury or a stroke, imply the same level of disability? The underlying question is, how do we know these items add up to mean anything consistent across populations? Second example question is, Mary's FIM improvement from 13 to 23 equivalent to Sam's improvement from 116 to 126. In other words, can we apply arithmetic operations to numbers like these? Can we subtract and discover that there's a 10-point difference? And is that 10-point difference the same across the entire rating scale? Some additional questions. Is the improvement between a FIM rating scale point of 1 and 2 equivalent to the distance between a 5 and a 6? That suggests, if they were the same, that the rating scale definitions were absolute and have the same quantity between them. But in fact, those rating scale definitions are arbitrary. They're defined by adjectives. Might mean different things to different people. The Barthel Index, on which the FIM is based, weights items. Does that affect the conclusions we might reach about disability severity? But questions like that reveal that item weights reflect the instrument developer's biases or intentions, which may not be realized mathematically. So these kinds of misunderstandings about measurement can limit our ability to construct measures of patient's impairment, disability, handicap. They can increase opportunities for what's called misinference, make discussions of improvement difficult, and limit our ability to compare patients with different underlying conditions. Well, let's take a step back and think about how we define measurement. I have advanced my slide, but that's not yet. Here it comes through the web slowly. So measurement helps us determine the magnitude of a specific attribute of an object, an organism, or an event. It ought to be acquired purposefully. It reflects a fixed unit, and it's typically expressed by a numeral. Let's take a familiar example, height. The attribute is height. The thing that we measure it with is often a ruler. It is the magnitude is the distance from one's toe to head. It can be expressed with a fixed unit, centimeter or inches, and expressed as a numeral. We think of height as equaling some number of centimeters. Pictured here is Benjamin Wright, a longtime professor at the University of Chicago's Mesa Laboratory, who brought George Rosh to the U.S. in 1960, and his friendship with him led to development of a number of books and computer programs. Ben was famous for carrying a ruler to illustrate measurement principles in lectures. The beauty of the ruler as a measurement system is that it's independent of its construction. We're fairly confident that one meter stick to the next is going to yield the same kinds of results. It implements the idea of a unit. There's a fixed number of centimeters or inches along that ruler. The unit, the centimeter, is the same everywhere along a ruler, whether from 2 to 3 or 31 to 32. It's a concrete realization of that unit. Those concrete units operationalize additivity, which is a very important principle We want to be able to add, subtract, multiply, divide in the inferential statistics that we use. They employ a natural number system. One more is one more is one more, and they add up to a total. And they implement a correspondence between units and numbers that is very intuitive. I think it's important to take a step back at this point and ask the question, how does measurement fit within a larger perspective of scientific inquiry? Ben Wright came up with this acronym, XOMAT, X-O-M-A-T, that I find very useful. We begin with an experience of the world, perhaps watching someone with a traumatic brain injury attempt to walk or to feed oneself or complete other activities of daily living. We systematize those observations. We make notes about how much assistance might be required or the kind of assistive device that's used. That allows us to come up with ways to measure the amount of assistance or the kind of device that's used. That numbers that result from that allows us to analyze and discover correspondence between different measures, which can inform theory. In turn, having a theory about how the world operates allows us to informs our experience of the world, which starts this loop of observation, measurement, analysis, and theory to proceed circularly. So measurement is central. It's right smack dab in the middle, and it informs a whole process of scientific inquiry. Well, let's ask now how constructs achieve a level of definition, how we go from experience to observation to defining constructs. At a very crude level, it's personal knowledge, it's intuition, subjectivity. In coming up with the idea of temperature, we might, as a child, have an idea that something's too hot to touch or something is as cold as snow. There are no units attached to that, but we have a ouch cold to an ouch hot continuum with different sensations in between. Some kinds of things we want to measure are a little more abstract and invisible. How much radiation exposure can we safely tolerate? How many airplane rides can we take? How close to a nuclear reactor might we be able to get? Sometimes the cause-effect relationships are rather distant, unlike the touching an object. Higher level of sophistication are database instrument calibrations. These are what our physical and occupational therapist friends love to use. Calipers to measure size, range of motion, ways to quantify that. Grip strength can be measured very precisely with instrumentation. There's some things, though, that don't lend themselves well to that kind of measurement, which is where rating scale analysis can be so useful. There are also theory-based instrument calibrations as well. The idea of a thermometer, where we know the expansion coefficients of different liquids, for example. We don't have to calibrate those thermometers once we are able to manufacture a glass tube and know what coefficient of expansion of mercury is. Those things, once they're specified by theory, work very well. Another example I'll return to a little bit later is the Lexile framework for reading comprehension. Jack Stenner and colleagues came up with a way to characterize reading difficulty, counting the length of words and the number of words per sentences. Sampling text and comes up with a very elegant way to assign text to children with different levels of reading ability. Well, let's ask the question next, how do numbers occur that might be associated with measurement? Sometimes they occur as labels, things like zip codes or house addresses or product codes. They might be random, they might be ordered in some sort of way, but there's a certain randomness sometimes to those. Sometimes numbers occur as counts or scores or as ranks. FIM scores are certainly familiar, where bigger is better, though we're not quite sure how much better is associated with bigger scores. Olympic placements, certainly first, second, third place winners are rank ordered, and however they differ in terms of units of speed or strength might vary between them, but there's a rank order that's quite understandable. And they can also occur as measures. I use the term measure to indicate that we have a reliable linear unit, hourly pay rate, for example. $11 an hour is a dollar more, 10% more than 10% per hour. Celsius degrees also have that linearity to them, which makes them very useful. I think we're all familiar with Stevens' classical ways of characterizing levels of measurement, nominal, ordinal, equal interval, and ratio. That concept is important to keep in mind as we move ahead, as we can make of ordinal data counts and ordered categories more useful information using the rating scale model. Kinston is also someone I think important to think about in the context of measurement. He distinguishes levels of representation where you have the distinguishes an entity, observable, comparable, measurable, and relatable kinds of representation. The entity has to do with an idea that we can identify or distinguish, a cat from a dog from a cow. An observable thingness we can point to, we can count more of the same things. Comparability representation has to do with ordering and ranking and valuing those comparisons. Having a standard units associated with his measurable level of representation, which allows us to do arithmetic. And then at a higher level of representation, a relatable issue is that we are connecting and formulating and making relations. We are probably doing inferential statistics at this level of representation. So to make this a little more concrete, an entity might be a disability, an observable thingness we might observe is mobility using a wheelchair. A comparability aspect has to do with how much assistance is required or the skill level that the person has. There may be a measurable unit associated with that. Some colleagues years ago came up with the idea of a rehabit, a rehabilitation functional unit. And at the level of relatability, we might understand how disability is reduced by environmental modifications. So there's a trade-off in terms of function and participation. Tried to expand this idea a little bit further in terms of talking about whether the source, the site of experience is more subjective or objective, the relevant notion, whether it has to do with plausibility, probability, and the error risk we run at each level when we make incorrect conclusions. So for, I won't read through this in great detail, but the idea is that at the entity, can we name what the thing is? This is at a level of subjectivity initially. The notion is, can we plausibly explain what that thing is? And if we go too far out on our own limb and lose contact with external reality, we'll have a concept that might have fantasy sense, but not a sense in reality. Often what we want to do in medical rehabilitation is to use numbers to compare and evaluate outcomes of patients or the progress they make during the course of rehabilitation. We want to be able to do things like, say, the 10 rehabilitation days that might cost $1,000 per day is more in some ways than 7 rehabilitation days that cost $1,200 a day. We also wanted to say things like a home discharge after 25 rehabilitation days is a better outcome than a nursing home discharge after 15 days. We might want to say that a 50 FIM point gain over 10 days is an average of 10 points per day, though unless we're confident that those points are the same across the range of FIM gain, we can't do that necessarily confidently. So to be able to make these kind of comparisons, we need arithmetic. We need to be able to add, subtract, multiply, and average. If we do that on labels or raw scores or counts or ranks, we end up with nonsensical kinds of numbers. We run the risk that conclusions may be misleading along Kingston's lines. We really need equal interval, constant unit, linear measures. So this idea of equal interval, constant unit, linearity, measuring one thing at a time in an equal unit way is a really critical idea. I think over the past 10 years or so, we've come to realize the limitations of raw scores and classical test theory. If we're going to judge correctly according to standard criteria, with ratings that are recorded accurately, with the assumption that numbers like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 are real measures for task performance. Those assumptions are unsound with raw scores. They may approximate reality if someone's done their homework well, but we can't be confident of that unless we have some way to evaluate reality. The thing to remember is that these ratings are guesses. They're prone to errors that reflect the amount of therapist training and estimating FIM scores. Standards can vary by time, by person, by facility, by the incentives that payers might impose, might be recorded incorrectly. It's important to keep in mind those are ranks. They may not add up. And ultimately, raw scores are never measures. What we need to do is have a way to transcend scores to construct measures, recognizing that all we can observe are counts and scores. They might provide the basis for constructing measures. We need to have a more sophisticated understanding of what scores mean. What matters is not what that score means, but what it implies, the construct, the latent idea that's beneath the actual number. We need a measure for using counts and scores to estimate the measures we want them to imply. Well, and that's what rating scale analysis or ROSH measurement is. It's a mathematical approach to providing that transformative analysis. Let me describe the essential conditions, the cause of response within the ROSH model. Imagine that you have two intersecting lines. Horizontally is how much a person has of a measure. Let's think of functional status. And let's imagine that we have items arrayed horizontally in terms of difficulty, from real easy, like brush teeth, to really hard, like run a marathon. The observed response, where the person, where they pass and fail or have great difficulty or no difficulty, that observed response in the ROSH model is predicated on the assertion that it reflects how much ability you have versus how hard the item is. Let me repeat that. That's the critical idea. The observed response depends upon how much ability the person has and how difficult the item is that you're using to measure. Now, here's several different scenarios. So these three horizontal lines, these rulers, represent three different situations. The top line, when the person's ability is greater than the item difficulty, B is further off to the right, and the horizontal double arrows illustrated right here represents the situation where the difference is positive. A person's ability minus item difficulty is greater than zero. And what we are interested in is estimating the probability that the person is going to pass the item. Well, it's easy to say here that it's probably greater than 50%. We don't know how much more, but if they have more of the ability than is necessary, they're going to pass. The middle line shows a situation where the person's ability is less than the item difficulty, illustrated by a horizontal line. In this situation, the difference between person ability and item difficulty is less than zero, and the probability is less than 50% that they're going to pass. Now, in situations where, and I should mention at this point that ROSH measurement really took off in educational research, and it's easy to default to examples like doing well on a math test or a reading test. There are situations where children might make lucky guesses on pronouncing a word or solving a math problem. So the probability isn't zero that they are going to pass, but it's substantially less than 50%. The bottom line illustrates a situation where the person's ability is exactly equal to the item difficulty, and in this situation, one would expect a 50% odds of pass or failing that item. If you were to add up or to plot the odds of passing over failing, probability of passing over the probability of failing, what we see is what's called the logistic response curve. The plot between more of the person ability plotted horizontally and the probability of a correct response shown vertically. This logistic response curve is the consequence of taking the log odds of passing over failing. In the middle, there's a relatively straight stretch of line where raw scores might well approximate the reality of trying to plot the relationship between a finite range of test scores and the infinite range of personability that you're trying to measure. Well, let me make this concrete. Imagine that this is functional status as measured by something like the FIM or the Parthel Index. As a person starts at very low levels and perhaps we find different people at higher levels of ability, the odds of passing increase at a very slow rate early on, at a linear rate in the middle, and then tends to flatten out at the top. This is a necessary mathematical consequence of trying to plot an infinite range of functional status to a finite range of scores on a given test. A very unhelpful unit of measurement in rating scale Roche model is the logit. It's a log odd units, logits for short. It's the log odds of the probability of success divided by the probability of failure, and that's set mathematically to the difference between the personability minus the item difficulty. That's the concept. It's the difference between how much of the quantity you have versus how difficult an item is that ratio of success over failure, taking the logs of that. It can be estimated independently of the items in a particular test. You can also specify more complex models. Imagine situations where you have different raters involved and you end up potentially calibrating the raters as well as the items and the people. Let me give a little more complex example here, back to rating functional status. Imagine that we have three observable categories: can't do, needs help, does fine, sort of like the Barthel Index does without the weighting. The numeric labels we might assign are 0, 1, and 2, and the associated probabilities are P0, P1, P2. The odds of transitioning from can't do to needs help is P1 over P0, and the transition odds from does fine or needs help to improving up to does fine is that probably P2 divided by P1. This interpretation gives those observed raw ratings inferential meaning. We have a sense of what the transition odds are between those rating scale categories. I promise I'm almost at the end of the equations here, and we can get on to a more intuitive sense of what this model is about. When we model these transition odds as a consequence of what's called conjoint additivity, we end up with parameters like this. The log odds of the passing for a given person, item, rater, whatever combination of things you're measuring, to the next rating scale category is the difference, simple difference, between personability and item difficulty. That's how conjoint additivity works. You want to model the difference between personability and item difficulty as those odds of passing or failing an item or transitioning from one rating scale category to the next. So let's define these model parameters a little bit more carefully. Imagine we have a functional status measure, B sub N, a patient N, and there we have numerous tasks, perhaps like the FIM, designated with I. So we have the difficulty of item I illustrated here. We can add additional model parameters if we want to. In addition to person ability and item difficulty, perhaps we have multiple clinicians involved, multiple PTs and OTs, with different levels of rigor in how they apply their understanding of the FIM. And then we have gradient steps across rating scale categories, from total assistance to max assist to mod assist. That could be modeled as F sub X. So what we get out of the rating scale analysis conceptually then is how difficult each task is. We can put the tasks on the ruler. We have a measure for each person. We know where they are centimeter-wise. We can also calibrate the raters. We know how rigorous each of them are. And we can identify the transition odds for those rating scale steps. Where is the transition point between a 1 and a 2? How broad is that two category relative to a one or a three? Some related things we get is the fit of each task to that underlying construct. Is it a relatively good or relatively poor? Does it pick up a lot of noise in measuring something else that's irrelevant? We can also get a fit of each person to the construct, and we can also identify the number of distinct strata, the separation of the sample into distinct strata. In other words, how long is that ruler? Let me give some concrete examples here. Imagine a depression test where various symptoms are assessed, including perhaps irritability, such as cheerfulness, such as social withdrawal. One of the classic symptoms is tearfulness, but there's a real gender difference in our culture, with men being much less likely to tear, at least to acknowledge doing that. That kind of gender difference can provoke noise in a response and create some item misfit. For an example of person fit, let me draw on a spinal cord injury example where, for most people, level of spinal cord injury from more distant to more proximal to the brain results in levels of paralysis, either complete or incomplete, that's pretty linear, whether it's legs that are affected at lower levels, only legs, or at higher tetraplegia levels, arms and legs are affected. That's generally true, except for people with something called central cord syndrome, where oftentimes their upper extremity motor function is relatively intact, in contrast to lower levels. Those folks with that syndrome misfit the typical pattern of item difficulty and person ability that's true for people without central cord syndrome. So that is a background. I think we're able to tackle the question of how good are measures produced by data. The Roche model answers the question, do data fit the measurement model? In other words, can you model performance as the consequence of person ability and item difficulty? The Roche model is not concerned with issues of guessing on item response, as is a problem in some educational testing. And it's also not concerned with an item response theory model where you are trying to find the best model to fit the data. The Roche model asserts that there is a best model, which is what are the probability of succeeding on each task, considering only person ability, item difficulty. The Roche model asserts that this is the way to understand the world. An IRT approach, in contrast, says, let's find the best model to find this particular collection of data points. Ultimately, we need some quality control method to make sure that a data set is working well from the Roche perspective. That's where fit statistics come in. They ensure that all items measure the same construct, people possess the same quality, and judges understand the same rating scale scheme. Now, there are two flavors of fit statistics, in-fit and out-fit. In-fit is sensitive to unexpected patterns in the data that are close to the person's ability level. It's inlier sensitive. In other words, responses that are close to where we expect the person to be would provoke inflated in-fit values. In contrast, outfit is sensitive to unexpected, outlying, off-target, low-information responses. I tend to focus less on those for evaluating item fit. For example, can I think of a good example, spur of the moment here? Imagine somebody on the FIM who's sort of mid-range, but reporting difficulty with an easy item. They're unexpectedly dependent on feeding, for example. Might be worth going back to see why they were getting more help with putting a straw in a milk carton or setups than would be expected. It may be that there was a rush to get the task done that day, so the therapist provided more assistance than was required. Perhaps a person is temporarily wearing a sling that might impair function. When you get odd patterns like that, it's helpful to go back and look at particular cases to see to diagnose what's going on. Some of the fit problems one might encounter are muted patterns when you have very small fit statistic values. This indicates that there's unmodeled dependency, redundancy, or some error trends going on. Typically, it's redundancy. It's an opportunity to delete items that are measuring something that other items are, and we can reduce respondent burden by getting rid of these overfitting items. Sometimes we see noisy patterns, and this is often a problem with large fit values. This reveals unexpected, unrelated irregularities. Back to the depression example, crying might not be a good symptom to measure if, in fact, there are gender differences, and you're going to be assessing both men and women. Another concept is that of reliability and separation. In the Roche model, the observed variance, as in most even classical test theory approach, is modeled as being the sum of true variance and error variance. True variance related to the ability of the person or the difficulty of the item, and error having to do with sloppy recording of responses or distracted test takers or distracted raters, depending upon the situation. Reliability is modeled as the ratio of that true variance over the error variance, and the related concept of separation is listed here as the model of the square root of the reliability divided by 1 minus reliability. In other words, the true standard deviation of variance divided by the error standard deviation. The important value of separation is it helps us identify the number of statistically distinct strata the test can identify in the sample in which the data were collected. So the higher the reliability, the wider the separation. As a rule of thumb, reliability of 0.80 means that you can distinguish, which is associated with the separation index of 2, means that you can reliably, I'll show you the formula in a little bit, distinguish three strata, low, middle, and high. So person separation allows us to define how well the items can resolve the sample into distinct strata. So talk about low-performing, middling-performing, high-performing people, for example. It describes the spread of the people in this sample. Get a new sample, the separation might be a little bit different. There are two flavors. Think of them as the unadjusted and the adjusted, or the ideal versus the real. The software programs implementing the Roche model help us identify the, in quotes, real separation, which adjusts for the misfitting person. So it takes that into account. Here's a really useful table. It comes from William Fisher's article in Roche Measurement Transactions from the Dark Ages. On the left-hand column is that separation ratio. And the typical corresponding KR20 alpha. In the far right-hand columns are the number of distinct strata that you can distinguish. It's a formula of 4 times that separation ratio plus 1 divided by 3. So you can see on the fourth row, when you achieve a separation ratio of 2, that typically corresponds to a KR20 alpha of 80, which reflects the percent of variance not due to error over that which is due to error, 80 over 20, and we can distinguish three strata. I get excited when we achieve a reliability of 80 and a corresponding separation ratio of 2, because that means we can do more than flip a coin and say a person is high or low. We can get into a little bit more precise measurement. I'm going to talk next about some common problems with rating scale structures. The FIM is a good example with this, with 7 rating scale categories and different definitions across different items. It's often the case that test developers provide more categories than a respondent can differentiate. Think of visual analog pain scale with 0 to 10 is also another good example. Apart from being a single item with unknown error, that's just more data points than people can reliably distinguish. Some categories are also defined in a way that makes it really hard to achieve rater consistency. How much assistance required? Is it often, frequently, sometimes? Are you providing assistance that's less than half or more than half? What do you think about making those judgments? It can create categories that are infrequently used and some problems with what are called item difficulty inversions, where reliability suffers basically because you're asking raters to make distinctions they have a hard time doing. Item fit can also worsen in this case, and as a consequence, one of the best strategy to improve or tune up an existing measure is to start by looking at the rating scale categories and seeing how well they're working. One question that often comes up is, how big a sample size do I need in order to be confident where those items are on the ruler? With dichotomous items, pass, fail, true, false, agree, disagree, this is a real useful table from Mike Lineker's article in Roche Measurement Transactions from now 20 years ago. Depending on how precisely you want to nail down where an item is, plus or minus one logit or down to half a logit, and whether you want to do that with 95 or 99% confidence, you can see the sample size required, depending upon how well targeted the test is to the sample, and his rule of thumb on the right-hand side, how many you need for most purposes. So if you're confident, if you want 95% confidence that you've nailed the item difficulty within one logit, 30 people will be enough. If you want to have 99% confidence of an item location within half a logit, you're looking at 150 cases. One of the sources of confusion that people often have is, how is factor analysis different from Roche analysis? Can I take those factor scores for an exploratory factor analysis and use those scores for people? And the answer is not a good idea, though certainly that's been done in the past. You're using the same kind of data, rating scale data oftentimes, but there are different interpretations of those numbers from a exploratory factor analysis versus a Roche analysis. There's similar estimation measure methods, but the measurement models are different. They try to solve the same kind of problems, but they have substantially different utility. The bottom line is that EFA results tend to be quite sample-dependent, and Roche analysis results tend to be much more robust across samples. Some of the problems of factor analysis are listed on slide 41. Factor scores are not linear. They're sample-dependent. The factor structure reflects the rating scale that's used. It's typically ordinal-level data that one is factor analyzing. You can end up with highly correlated factors and items that are loading on multiple factors. A real pragmatic consideration is you need complete data. If you've got missing data, the case is dropped and your power suffers. Oftentimes, the identity of smaller factors can be overwhelmed by residuals from the preceding larger factors, and there's no way to evaluate the relative importance of those. There's certainly scree plot guidelines that people can use to, you know, how many factors do I want to extract, but sometimes the results vary a lot depending upon how many factors you decide to keep. And standard errors for those factor scores are hard to obtain. Well, let me summarize the points I made here before we transition to some examples. Rating scale analysis gives you person and item separation. Ultimately, how long is that ruler, and how well do the items spread the people across that ruler? In general, greater spread is a good thing, and you need greater reliability in order to achieve that. Persons and items both have fit statistics associated with them. You can appreciate whether an item is redundant or whether it is kind of noisy and picking up something irrelevant to the construct you're trying to measure. And similarly, can I diagnose people for whom the overall measurement model does not work really well? Think again of the folks with central cord syndrome. Ultimately, we usually are doing a rating scale analysis in order to define personability and item difficulties. We want those personabilities nailed down so we can use them for inferential statistics subsequently. Sometimes, and oftentimes, and this ought to be done first, we look at how well the rating scale is working and whether the number of categories is appropriate and whether they're defined clearly enough. So how does one approach, hey, I got a diet an item set. I wonder how well the data conform to the Roche model. I'd like to extract a measure from this to use in some other test. Well, some general guidelines is you want that person separation to be at least 2.0, so you have a reliability associated with that of 0.80. You want to make sure that the item set structures are clear. Sometimes we combine rating scale categories together. We collapse all of those needs assistance into they need assistance. We don't care how much, it's just they need assistance. Then we examine the item fit statistics and try to identify items that are candidates for deletion, or sometimes item fit improves when we take care of step category problems. It's helpful to identify misfitting people for whom does the overall model not work. It's important to look at how well the items target the sample. Imagine giving a fifth grade reading test to a third grade sample. There are going to be some stars that will be above the floor, but there are going to be a lot of people at the floor. It's important to target the test on the sample. Another way to think of this in rehabilitation is the FIM might be really appropriate for inpatient settings, but not so useful for outpatient or community settings. In terms of having some faith that the construct we're measuring really makes sense, it's helpful to look at a person and item map to assure ourselves that the construct being measured really makes sense. So I've emphasized that fixing rating scale problems is something one ought to do first. And when designing a test, it's important to think whether a single or multiple rating scales would be appropriate. Sometimes test developers have some pass-fail, true-false items mixed in with rating scales of different length. It's important to be very intentional about why you're designing a test in this way and to think through logically the certain patterns of response indicate more of the thing I'm trying to measure. To helpful to verify the rating scale behavior, try it out, collect data, look at the odds of having a higher measure on your test, look across the range of how people respond to individual items. Should look at the range of item difficulties and fit statistics, and consider the range of person ability estimates, fit statistics, and whether there's subgroups of people that need to be distinguished. I realize I raced through those examples or those caveats quickly. Let's get back to how some of our prior work has informed these answers to questions or suggest answers to questions I asked earlier on. So to the question, does a total FIM score of 70 obtained from two different kinds of diagnostic groups imply the same level of disabilities? What we've learned is they mean approximately the same thing. You can fine-tune a measure for specific impairment groups. Typically, we don't want to. We want something that's going to work broadly. And in those cases, a FIM score of 70 means approximately the same thing. In answer to the question, is Mary's FIM improvement from 13 to 23 equivalent to Sam's improvement from 116 to 126? No, raw scores are not measures. You saw that ogival Loget curve. Yes, there's a linear stretch in the middle, but at the extreme, a little bit of improvement means a lot of gain on the underlying measure, and the same thing at the bottom end of the scale. Next question, is the improvement between a FIM rating scale point of 1 and 2 equivalent to the distance between a 5 and 6? No, it's not, but that improvement can be calibrated, and we can know how much more improvement there is between a 1 and a 2 as between a 5 and a 6. And finally, does the Barthel Index item weighting affect conclusions about disability severity? Absolutely, it does. It confounds measurement. It pretends that the weighting makes sense, though it has not been verified quantitatively. Let me transition in the time remaining and give a few examples of some Roche-developed measures. And just by way of introduction, for a different lecture I did last fall, I looked through the web of knowledge and did a search for key terms Roche and rehabilitation and looked to see how many papers have been published since Web of Knowledge began tracking these things in 1996. You can see a first citation back, actually that's 1986, with growth remarkably over the years. The 2013 drop is only reflects the fact that I did not do the search at the end of the calendar year, but about a year ago from now. I'm confident that the number of publications continues to improve. In all, there are 525 Roche-related articles in rehabilitation. Some of the journals in which they appeared were the Archives of PM&R, Journal of Rehab Medicine, Disability and Rehabilitation, and how about that? Investigative Ophthalmology and Visual Science was another one. Looking just in the November issue of Archives of PM&R, looking for Roche keywords, it was a banner month with four articles by Hayes, myself, Angst, and Major, looking at everything from the Berg balance test to looking at sample with hip and knee osteoarthritis. I was interested in measuring an aspect of participation, and Ron Hayes looked at physical function as measured by the PROMIS family of measures. Mentioned before the Lexile framework that Stenner developed. What this, won't go into all the mathematics of it, this, but it's absolutely amazing bit of work that he's done, where he's mapped out grade levels to corresponding Lexile text range units. And as a consequence, with simply counting the number of words per sentence and or words per sentence and I believe sentences per paragraph, he has ended up with being able to map the difficulty of different texts on average, and knowing a student's reading level can make recommendations that correspond to reading level. Typically, one recommends texts are just a little bit harder, a little bit challenging, so that a student learns a little bit more. It's an absolutely brilliant application of the Roche model. Closer to home, let me give you an example in the rehabilitation arena. At our current RRTC on improving outcome measures, we got a project focused on developing measures of environmental factors for several populations. We started with a conceptual framework, always good to do that, even with particularly with the Roche measurement, in which we distinguished the social environment, access to information and technology, assistive technology, the built natural environment, system services and policies, and a new realm we came to call economic quality of life. This reflects our appreciation of the International Classification of Functioning, Disability, and Health, but also informed by a number of focus groups that we ran with patients and providers and others to gain input as to what they regarded as critical aspects of the environment that influences patient outcomes in the community. This next slide is a kind of busy table showing the ICF taxonomy. On the left-hand column, ICF distinguishes products and technology. In our framework, we focused on assistive technology initially. We reviewed the literature, found 178 items initially. We winnowed those down to 104. We looked at what those items were measuring and whether we wanted to retain this conceptual category of assistive tech. We did. And we finally ended up with 15 items after cognitive testing and pilot data collection. The ICF next category talks about the natural environment and human-built changes to it. We distinguished initially the natural and the built environment. We have a number of instruments, binned a whole bunch of them, windowed them down to 37 and 51 respectively after cognitive testing, pilot testing. We decided that that distinction didn't make sense. The ICF had it right. Whether it's dangerous to walk on a sidewalk because there is ice on it in wintertime, and trying to call that a natural feature of the environment or the built aspect, decided snow or ice on sidewalks was the outdoor world. We weren't going to make a distinction. We ended up with 36 items. We went forward to test. And you can see that we did the same thing in other categories as well. I'm going to focus just on that economic quality of life aspect next. We started with 24 items with a sample of 604 people that we completed testing on in the last year. We started, as you can see in the first column, analysis one, with 24 items, a 5 rating scale category of how much difficulty, I think it was a frequency option of never to always. And we had 1,812 people that we initially analyzed. That set of 24 items, 5 category rating scale, 1,812 people yielded a person reliability of 0.91, an item reliability of 1.0. Looks real promising. The rating scale looked good. Increases from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 were consistent increases in difficulty across the range of the scale. But we had problems with 3 misfitting items. I haven't shown them to you yet. You see them in a little bit. It had to do with issues of having good credit, being able to afford school, whether you'd save 6 months of living expenses. None of the items correlated weakly with the overall measure, less than 0.4. We did a principal component analysis of the residual information after extracting that first Roche factor. Didn't talk a lot about that earlier in this hour. Apologize. Basically, one wants less than 10% residual variance. And we achieved that. So things are looking really good. However, because the response categories of 1 and 2, while they were distinguishable, weren't that distinguishable, we thought, let's try combining categories 1 and 2 and see if that helps. So in analysis 2, we've got 24 items, 4 categories, same number of people. We've improved the reliability, person reliability a little bit. Rating scale is still fine. But we didn't fix any of the item fit problems. And the residual variance is still okay. So at this point, we decided to delete 3 misfitting items, 3 that were really noisy, measuring other things than the underlying construct. And it's often the case if you only peel off the most overfitting, then the next most overfitting ones, misfitting items that are left in will misfit in the next analysis. Fit is a relative concept, so unless you balance your item deletion by getting rid of overfitting items simultaneously with getting rid of misfitting items, you end up with that often yields a more satisfactory solution. And in fact, that's what we did in the third analysis. With now 18 items, getting rid of the 3 most misfitting and overfitting items, same reduced rating scale category, we've reduced the person reliability a little bit, but not much. Rating scale still works fine. Nothing misfits. All the items are correlating well with the overall measure, and we don't have a problem with a secondary hidden dimension. At that point, we blessed it and said these 18 items are what we want to work with. And now we have a map. We have a ruler. That green line from the bottom to the top shows low levels of economic quality of life to high levels of economic quality of life. And we have something with the pound signs on the left indicating people, a relatively normal distribution, a little bit of a ceiling and a bit of a floor effect. The folks at the top who are so well-to-do that they're not experiencing any economic pressures. The X's on the right-hand side show the location of the items along the ruler. You can see that there's kind of a bunching up in the middle, but there is a spread of people, or pardon me, a spread of items across that ruler. The software program that I use to produce these results is called WinSteps. This is one of the tables one gets from there. The horizontal ruler from low to high is illustrated from -3 to +3 logits at the bottom. And each of those curves, the one starting at the top left and descending to the right, and then the 2 and 3 and 4, you can see that they're distinct mountain peaks, as it were. Imagine you're in Chris Pretz's backyard looking at the Rocky Mountains. Even though there's some mountains more distant and some closer, you can see the peaks distinctly. And what you hope is that, in looking at a graph like this, that there's some range of that measure where each response is most probable and a relatively broad range. You can see that, imagine you're sliding down the hill from left to right, the odds of responding so 1, which is never, are very high at the left. You kind of bounce down across the 2 for a little bit of a stretch. Then you're up on the 3, the usually range. And as you go way high on the scale, always is the most likely response option. Well, here are the items at last. Break the mystery of what items we retained. They're all positively worded. I have enough income to live the life that I want is the most difficult item to agree with. At the bottom is the easiest item to agree with. I can afford to feed myself and my family. And as you look from the bottom to the top, you can see that there's sort of paying for the necessities at the bottom. And then when you've got discretionary income at the top, things you can do with more money. I can afford to live where I want. I can afford to travel. I have extra money in case of an emergency. Some of the statistics that you get out of the Roche analysis are shown here. The measure column is the difficulty of the item, where the item is on the ruler. We saw a graphical representation of that a bit ago. We also have the standard error of associated with each measure, which is really small, which is nice to see. We have the infit, the inlying fit measure. It comes in two flavors, a mean square value and a standardized residual. I tend to prefer that mean square. The modeled value one hopes to see is a 1.0. Values greater than 1.4 indicate a lot of noise and are candidates for deletion. I've highlighted 1.35 in red just to flag the most misfitting item. It's not a problem, but it's labeled so you can identify it. And the item is, I have access to extra money in the case of an emergency. Now, reflecting on that, why might people with relatively high levels of economic resources not have extra money set aside? I think we can all think back to our own development where maybe we're spending money on travel and housing, but we haven't saved a lot of money in case of emergency. We're kind of paycheck to paycheck. We're flying high, but if there's an emergency, we're not prepared. So I think that reflects relatively well-to-do people who haven't saved that extra money. Rest of the fit statistics look pretty good. The most overfitting item is at 0.76, three up from the bottom. I can afford to pay my bills on time. That reflects the fact, this is kind of the epitome. If there's one item that's a little redundant, that's the one. It's not problematic, but being able to pay bills on time, so there's another way of putting this, if you only had to ask one question, this is what that construct is about, at least at the low end of the continuum. The I-M, the item measure correlation, is shown in the next column. We're seeing some really strong values here. Every item is correlated with the total measure. I realize we are run a full hour. Let me tell you about some resources you might find useful for further reading. This book by Trevor Bond and Christine Fox is very accessible. They have a second edition out of Applying the Roche Model. You can find it through Amazon and other sources. A book that Nick Brzezinski produced, an edited book, Roche Measurement in Health Sciences, is another really useful resource. It's an edited text. It's available from JAM Press. JAM is a Journal of Applied Measurement. It is the publisher of the Journal of Applied Measurement, which you might find useful to peruse. It doesn't have very wide circulation. I do believe it's in PubMed so that you can track down articles that way. And finally, a web resource that's really useful that's developed by the Institute for Objective Measurement. Easy to remember website, Roche.org, has a variety of resources as well as access to Roche measurement transactions. You can see that on the left-hand side of the screen towards the bottom, as well as links to software programs available for purchase. Let me leave you with some images to summarize what we've been talking about today. All of the images below are of things that fly, birds and kites and planes and rockets. The idea that birds of a different feather might flock together, are these all birds? Are these all the same construct? Are all they the same thing? We can't verify that unless we evaluate whether they add up to measure the same resource. So by getting rid of things that misfit this construct, what we're left with are something that's a little bit more pure. We have the concept of avian creatures, things that fly, whether it's a snowy owl or a black-crowned night heron or a northern cardinal or cedar waxwings. These are things that fly, and maybe we're interested in how far or how fast or whether they migrate or not, but we're confident that they are all birds. If we have time, I'm available for a little bit of discussion at this point.
Yeah, thank you, Alan. I appreciate that. That was great. So,
thanks, Chris.
Your lectures are always intriguing. So, are there any questions for Alan? If you can't use your mic, feel free to type in a question under the public chat option.
Apologize for the difficulty with the phone number. I'm glad that everybody on the webinar figured it out. I hope that others who may want to see this are available, able to view the archive. I see some people on here who've actually used the Roche model, including Dr. Malik. We haven't heard from him, and I'm not sure he's able to hear us.
Alan, are you still with us?
I'm still here, yes. Can you hear me?
Well, maybe it's just me that can't hear anyone. I can hear you now. You know, for those that are interested, Alan's slides will be posted on the NDSC website. You know, I'm clearly recording this, and last time we recorded it as well, and for some reason it just didn't work, so hopefully the entire discussion will be available on the NDSC website, and I can send out more information about that when it applies. But at the very least, we will post these slides on our website.
And I'm happy to entertain questions by email afterwards. Let me acknowledge funding sources that have made possible my participation today. The Rehabilitation Research and Training Center on Improving Measurement of Medical Rehabilitation Outcomes, Midwest Regional Spinal Cord Injury Care System, both of which are funded by NIDRR, which is no longer with the U.S. Department of Education, but is transitioning to Health and Human Services.
Well, if there are no questions, Alan, again, thank you very much for the talk. I appreciate it. Did a great job.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And did you provide your email address anywhere for follow-up questions?
You know, I didn't, but let me type it in right now in case anyone doesn't have it so that they can follow up by email. It's just first initial hyphen last name at northwestern.edu.
Very good. Well, I will stop recording the webinar, and we will draw to a conclusion.
Thanks, everyone, for joining today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.